Welcome to the Franziska Show podcast on JewishCoffeeHouse.com, the show where I give a voice to Jewish issues, topics, and people. I'm Franziska Frady, your host. I hope you had a beautiful and meaningful Purim. I wanted to share that last week's concert, Purim Chagiga, was something spectacular that I'm so happy I got to experience. The place was rocking, and I think I found my niche, the high school Sparty audience is just a perfect fit for me. Anyway, there was something super heartbreaking about seeing the names of the hostages in Shalach Manos, seeing the different posts online. It was a Purim we've never had before, that's for sure. Today's episode is commenting on the new developments in the Aguna fighting campaigns. And I brought Keshet Star on to talk about the strategies and work that they do at Aura that is effective and that no one knows about because it's effective. And the only reason you know about the mikvah strike is because of those loud, fewer cases. I do want to recommend an episode on Chochmah Nashim from last week, where Shoshana Keats Jaskel and Ann Gordon had Flatbush girl Adina Miles, Adina Sashon, to talk about the intricacies of the campaign and what's been going on. So I definitely recommend that. I hope you enjoyed this episode. So here we go. Welcome to the Franziska Show. Keshet Star, so great to have you on again.
Thank you so much for having me. Looking forward.
The first time we had you, you spoke about the organization Aura, which we'll have you introduce yourself and the organization. Second time around, we had you for a personal story, and we might link it if you'd like. And then today we're back on to talk about that first topic again, given this topic is loud in the public space now, and it's relevant to address what the other resources that are available out there. That's why we're having this conversation. So welcome, and tell us a little bit about yourself.
I'm Keshet Star. I'm the CEO of ORA, the Organization for the Resolution of Agunot. I'm an attorney by training and sort of an accidental nonprofit leader. I work to help free Agunot, which I know we're going to share a lot more about. And when I'm not doing that, I live in New Jersey with my family. I have too many hobbies, and that's really what keeps me busy.
When you say the Organization for Resolution of Agunot, what does that mean?
We are a nonprofit organization that works to help Agunot. So we are working with people who are trying to get a Jewish divorce, not able to do so. But in addition to helping people who are struggling today, the goal is also to create change on a wider scale so that we don't see the same issues happening over and over again for the next 20 years or 50 years. So what we do now basically is help people at different points in the process, because while we are absolutely here to help people that are in these sort of terrible, long-standing Jewish divorce denial cases, if we can stop those cases before they develop, if we can guide people from the very beginning of the process, and if we can implement tools that prevents this from happening to begin with, that's really the goal, to really limit the amount of suffering that people have to go through and to intervene as early as possible so that over time we see less and less full-on Aguna cases.
So I would like to go and hear more about those full-on Aguna cases, but before, I'd like to hear what are the stages and what are some of the methods that can be used to intervene?
Many of the cases that we work on that become those sort of full-fledged cases have a history of domestic abuse. And the way domestic abuse works is that you have, instead of sort of a relationship that's built on a foundation of trust and respect, it's a relationship that's built on a foundation of control and domination. And so if you're in a relationship that's built on trust and respect, and that isn't there anymore, it's excruciatingly painful, but you can turn to the other person and say, you know, the love and the connection and the trust that we really hoped for isn't here. And I feel that I have to end this relationship. But when you're in a relationship that's really built again on this foundation of control and domination, you can't really turn to the other person and say, you know, this has been fun, but I realized I actually don't like being controlled and dominated, so I'm going to leave. It just doesn't work that way. And so if you are in a relationship that's characterized by these abusive power and control dynamics, then even at the stage where you're thinking about leaving, you really want to get as much information as possible and really set yourself up for success strategically, because getting out of these relationships is really, really hard. And any sort of tweak in the system that might be passively manipulated is going to be manipulated. That is what happens when you leave a controlling relationship. And so a part of what we're doing is working with people at that very early stage. I'm thinking about divorce, or I've decided to pursue divorce, but I haven't even told my partner. And really, for people in that situation that are in abusive relationships, figuring out how can you learn as much as possible about the process so that you have really excellent strategy when you then pursue the divorce. Because when the strategy is not there, abusers really take advantage of that, and it can make the entire divorce just much longer, much more high conflict, much more fraught. So part of the intervention is right at that step one of divorce. How can we guide you through the very, very early decisions so that you are set up for success based on the dynamics of your relationship and based on what matters most to you?
The question that begs here is, what constitutes an abusive relationship? Because ultimately, that's the only card that the woman has to play where it puts her in the right, especially when it comes to custody. Obviously, that's going to be the first thing, not obviously, but any man who is being divorced or asked to be divorced is going to say she thinks it's abusive. And it's a he said, she said at this point of the conversation. But if you can tell us what's an abusive relationship and give us some examples versus something that it may be convenient to turn this situation into abusive relationship, go ahead.
So that's a really important question, and I'm really glad you asked, because the question of sort of false accusations and how does that impact things is really fundamental. One thing I'll share first is that I often find that what happens is that the community and the Jewish community at large often has a vision and understanding of the legal system that's really not sort of up to the times in terms of what's happening in the legal system. So one thing that's really good to know is that if the legal system views one party as an abuser, that doesn't tend to impact custody a whole lot, and it doesn't impact property. And so the question of sort of who gets what and where are the kids going to be on a Wednesday night, that's typically not getting changed based on the fact that one person is considered to be abusive. Now, there are a lot of advocates for abuse survivors that don't like that. So whether it should be that way or it shouldn't be that way is a different conversation. But it's just good to know that a sort of understanding of abuse is not really changing what happens in the divorce almost all of the time. That being said, a lot of people wonder, how do you know what's abuse versus an unhealthy relationship or a toxic relationship or two terrible people who are, you know, just having a terrible relationship when they get together? And one of the best ways to pick it out, I would say, is that abuse tends to be primarily one-sided, not necessarily all the time, every time, but for the most part. So I'll share, for example, and I want to credit Shalva, which is a domestic abuse organization in Chicago that has an amazing chart on this that I'm quoting from that chart. But they basically give examples of what's happening in a healthy relationship, an unhealthy relationship, and an abusive one. So say, for example, finances. In a healthy relationship, you might disagree on how to spend money. So I'll share, in my marriage, I am very much the spender. I like, you know, the nice things. And my husband would happily live on like a futon on the floor for the rest of his life and would happily not spend any money ever. And so you can have different spending styles, but in a healthy relationship, you agree on some core values that maybe I like to spend more than you, but we both care about being able to, you know, pay our mortgage and being able to pay tuition. We both care about being able to give charity. You know that if you can share certain core values, you can make decisions about money that are joint decisions and that you both can live with. In an unhealthy relationship, money might be a real source of tension. Financial disagreements are one of the biggest causes of divorce, actually. And we might never come to terms on how to spend our money. So maybe I want to go on vacation to the Ritz-Carlton and you want to go camping in the backyard and we never agree on a compromise. So we never, ever go on vacation. Or we use money in secretive ways. So a lot of people joke about like hiding the Amazon packages from their husbands, but that sort of element around secrecy and they don't have to know. And, you know, that's also an unhealthy money dynamic that can show up in relationships. But here again, you kind of have two people who can't get on the same page about enough core values and decisions that they can have a healthy relationship around money. And then if we switch to an abusive relationship, in an abusive relationship, one person controls the money and one person doesn't. One person has access to accounts and passwords and financial reports. One person does not. One person makes decisions. How are we going on vacation? In the healthy relationship, you agree. Maybe I'd like to go to a high-end place. You want to go to a low-end place. We'll find a place in the middle, or we'll go to the nicer place for a shorter time. You find ways to make it work. Unhealthy relationship, you never go on vacation because you can't agree. Abusive relationship, one person is making that decision. These are not relationships where both people have a say in what happens and what should happen and what the values should be. So it's typically that kind of one-sided nature that makes it a more classic abusive relationship. And there's a point where you could also argue that how much does it matter? Again, if you have a really unhealthy relationship, that can also lead to a very toxic divorce. Or I have a friend that will say when talking to women who are dating, don't stay up all night debating if it's unhealthy or abusive, because like it's not great either way, right? We're looking for the healthy relationships. We're looking to build healthy relationships from the dating stage into the marriage stage. Once we're in that unhealthy, abusive territory, you can sometimes, you'll have people that are more on one end of the extreme or the other. But again, what's going to really characterize abuse is that one-sided aspect, which is not what you will see in the typical unhealthy or toxic relationship.
Would you say most of the cases that come up or that you work with are in that unhealthy space? Meaning the woman is working and she has some sort of access to at least some of the money and she doesn't participate in the decision making. And now they separated and the kids are with her and the court mandated kids with the father every other weekend and she's covering the bills, but she wants child support. And he's saying she's claiming abuse. Now he doesn't want to lose his kids. And this limbo now is going on for a year, then 2 years, and there's no get. And is that a get refuser? Is that where you do most of your work before it goes to Basedon?
So it's a very good question. And we work, again, with people at all stages of the process. So when it comes to the full Aguna cases, these are typically cases that have been going on at least, I mean, I can't think of a case that's been going on less than 6 or 7 months that would come to us, but they've typically been going on at least 1 or 2 years. There's some element of a Basedon or Jewish religious court process that's happened. And they're coming to us after that. And the person, these are cases where someone has basically allowed a Basedon to issue a ruling against them rather than give a get. So they're fairly committed to not giving a get. And in those cases, there is often that real history of abuse. And that abuse is often extreme, not always, but very often. When it comes to our Jewish divorce helpline, we're working with people at all different stages of the process, and that can have much more of a range of unhealthy to healthy, et cetera. It's also important to know that you can have someone who works and has their own money, you know, ostensibly they have a salary, but in an abusive relationship, they may not have access to that money. They may not be able to make decisions about how that money is spent. There might be a dynamic where money is used to control them. So I worked with a woman once who would get this very strict budget every week for how much she was allowed to spend. The budget was not realistic for how many children she had and what it costs to run a household. And basically to punish her, her husband would then lower the budget. And he would also use the budget to track her. So where did you buy this toothpaste? Why was it $4 and not $3? Where did you go to buy it? I told you to go to that other place. And it was basically an opportunity to control her movements. So when we're talking about financial abuse, we're talking about situations where there is often a you know it when you see it, that these are very, very different scenarios from what you would see in a healthy relationship. So you, especially once these relationships have developed and the abuse has really come out, you can't really confuse this relationship with a healthy one. In terms of the argument, and I'm so glad you brought this up because I feel like this is the number one question I get, is kind of that question of, but doesn't the guy, the man, sometimes need the get in order to be able to have access to their children? That isn't that his leverage, much like, you know, other things might be considered to be her leverage. And the way I answer that is that, first of all, so much has changed on the legal scene in a way that a lot of people just don't realize, that mothers do not have full control of custody. More and more states are actually establishing laws that the default is pretty even 50-50 custody. And you have to argue for why it shouldn't be that way if you don't want it to be that way. And so what we are seeing is that courts recognize that children generally do better with meaningful access to both parents. They expect there to be meaningful access. And if you go into court anything less than thrilled for your ex to have tons of time with your children, that can backfire on you. And the court might consider you to be a hostile parent and give you less parenting time. And so what's happening in courts is that there is very much a lean towards joint custody. People will still say, well, it costs money to fight in court. That's true. There's always a reality in any system, whether the legal system or the Jewish legal system, that the person who has more money to some extent has more power because fighting in these systems costs money. At the same time, I think what we always have to prioritize in these conversations is that we can get so caught up in what are the rights of the father and what are the rights of the mother and who gets what. But at core, the most vulnerable players in that process and the most voiceless are the children. Older teenagers will have some say over where they go often, not always, but young children don't have a voice in this process. And so I think we always have to keep in mind, and as much as my organization is not about children of divorce, that's not our focus, we're always very mindful of the fact that they're the most vulnerable and voiceless players here. And so we have to think about what's healthy for children. And the best thing for children, honestly, is if the parents can agree on a schedule and structure that they can live with. And they might need outside help to come to an agreement. But that's the ideal, that mom and dad get on the same page. If that can't happen, and sometimes it can't, and I work on a lot of those cases where you really can't get there, the next best option is for a neutral third party to make a decision. And the risk of saying, well, it's okay to use the get as leverage in order to get the custody arrangement you want, is that sometimes parents are advocating for custody arrangements that really don't make sense. And they're using the get as leverage to try and force those arrangements through. But if that succeeds, you now have children that are stuck in a setup that really isn't healthy or safe for them. And we don't want that. So I'll share as an example, I had a case once where the father wanted, the parents lived in different states, father wanted the children, there were several children, to be enrolled into two different schools and to live in one state for a week and go to school one and then live in the other state for a week and go to school two, and to basically boomerang every single week between states and between schools. And you don't have to have a degree in child psychology to know that that doesn't work. That doesn't make sense. You know, you're going to learn the letter B twice and totally miss C. Like, it's not a reasonable way to go to school. But this parent really felt like this was the best arrangement. And he was using the get as leverage to try and push that arrangement through. And so the second we open the door for using the get as leverage to get the custody arrangement you want, we open the door for really risking children's safety in the end. Because I wish we lived in a world where we could always trust parents to want to do the best things for their children. But that's not the reality of the world we live in. And we don't know who's telling the truth and who isn't. You mentioned the he said, she said. And that piece is very hard to get around. We don't know who's lying to us. And someone could seem really nice and really convincing and be lying to us. And we don't know. So the best option we have, as much as it's not a perfect option, the best option we have is to allow a third party, like a court or a bastion. In particular, a court has the ability to access evidence in a way that us as individuals don't. And to have a neutral third party make a decision, because that is ultimately what really protects children the most in that big picture.
What about the statement that the get should be done at the same time as the civil divorce because it's not kosher otherwise? Have you heard that claim?
Yes, I have heard that. There are different halakhic views on when the get should be given. And the Beth Din of America just published an article about this. So there are views that the get should be the last order of business and it should be done along with the civil divorce. However, there are many arguments that say that this actually doesn't work halakhically if the divorce is taking a certain length of time. So if it's going and going, we can't just leave it till the end of the civil. And there's an idea that this timing made sense in a context where a bastion had real enforcement power. And if you weren't listening to the bastion, you could really get into trouble. But that in today's day and age, where bantijin are so limited in what they can do to enforce their rulings, that this actually doesn't make sense. So what we would love to see is really a shift towards giving the get at the beginning. And the reason is that, first of all, I think we take a big chance. We never know at the beginning of a divorce what that divorce is going to look like. And if it ends up being this like 7-year long, super nasty battle, the odds of someone at the end of that being like, sure, here's your get, are not very high. And also we run the risk of the get being used as an extortionary tool, that the get is being used as leverage. And when we deal with the get in the beginning, we really get that out of the way. And the other thing I'll say on this is that I really believe that giving the get at the beginning is actually to everyone's benefit. That I think what happens is that people think that, oh, I'm going to keep the get as an insurance policy, and then I'll make sure that this divorce is ultimately smoother and I get more of the things that I want. But then it often backfires. And the other person is like, well, if you're not going to give me my get, then I'm not going to cooperate with you. And then maybe I'm going to go empty the bank accounts, or I'm going to go, you know, do X, Y, Z. And you have this dynamic where the hostility is just increasing. Everyone feels like they can't trust the other person. And what happens at the end of those divorces is that you have a custody arrangement often that is highly specific. You can't change a single thing without everyone needing to go to court because the relationship has deteriorated so much. And it often leaves people ultimately with less time. They certainly have less money in their bank accounts once they've gone through a long, you know, court battle or bastion battle. And they actually often end up with less time with their kids. And I have never seen someone withhold a get and end up in a better relationship with their children as a result. Because this woman is also your children's mother. So even if you think that she is the nastiest piece of work to hit planet Earth, you could think that, but your children are going to have a more complex relationship with her. And so it ultimately hurts both people. And I think what you see is that people do this thinking that it's going to help them. Sometimes it comes out of an anxiety that I can very much understand. There's so much messaging about men and fathers and not having access to things that it makes people very upset, very nervous. And then they might want to use the get to sort of feel like they have a sense of control over the process. But it really almost always leads to a much longer, more bitter, more acrimonious divorce. And that means less money and less access to your kids. Because the best way to have as much time with your kids as possible is to have a decent working relationship with the other parent. That's what allows you to say, hey, I was going to have the kids this weekend, but I have a wedding out of town. Why don't you babysit? And in these super hostile divorces, that never in a million years happens. It's really, it ends up, I think, much more limiting for everyone. And I think it just gives everyone less of what they want the most.
I just think this would be so helpful for certain people to hear, but I don't think they'll get through this episode to this part of the episode because half of the things you already said, they disagree with. Like saying the words, getting the get out of the way is already totally triggering or in disagreement with everything they believe. And they just don't hold by that to begin with. They're like, I don't want to give a get. That's not kosher. I remember hearing that when I was like 8 years old. It's not kosher if I give it now. I'm trying to be, you know, machmer.
One thing I'll say very quickly, though, is that there really are not opinions. As far as I understand, there are not sort of mainstream halachic opinions that you cannot give it earlier. There are opinions that you don't have to, that you're not obligated until the civil divorce kicks in. But there really aren't mainstream voices that say, if you decide I'm 6 months into a divorce, I want to give a get, that that get would then be invalid. So that's something that's sort of a twist on the concept, but is important to understand. There's nothing stopping you from giving it earlier. There might be a view, according to some halachic decision makers, that you don't have to give it earlier. But the idea that if you give it earlier, now it's, you know, not a kosher get, that is not sort of a mainstream view.
Let's go into the topic of today. The big get refusers, the relationship is insalvageable in terms of them resolving anything on their own. Outside intervention is the only option. I spoke to you last week, I believe, or 2 weeks ago, and you said that Ora is involved with many different strategies, and they're not necessarily in the public eye, which is why I invited you on, because everyone is desperate to hear what's being done. So I'd like to hear about the successful strategies that you use.
So the first thing we do on any case, and this is just important to know, is that we just gather information and we always, always give the get refuser an opportunity to share their perspective. And not in a, we know you're evil, but if you want to tell us your story, you can. We really are open-minded to that conversation. And sometimes the communication with the get refuser itself really gets the job done and leads to a get. So that can happen. And again, we want to understand where they're coming from. We want to understand what they're afraid of. We want to see if there are ways we can reassure them about some of the things that they're afraid of so that they can feel comfortable going forward. So there's always an open line of communication. If they choose to curse us out and hang up the phone, that's their choice. And, you know, ultimately it's up to them if they're going to speak with us or not. But we always open that door because we do feel that it's really important and it's important to us in general to treat everyone with humanity, even those that we feel are perpetrating abuse. We're still going to treat them with a basic level of courtesy and humanity that's important to us. So we always just get information, allow the other person to express where they're coming from and why. We then pursue any amicable means that is possible to pursue a get. So we really believe the get should be separate from the other issues. That being said, if they're 1 inch apart on the other issues, maybe we can help facilitate that conversation and include the get as part of a global deal if they're close already. If there is another element, so say we know that the get refuser is really worried about being arrested for something that he did in the past, and she has no intention of pursuing charges on that. Maybe she can reassure him about that, and then we can move forward. So if there are non-extortionary avenues to get things done in sort of a calmer way, we will absolutely do that. And that can also include behind the scenes efforts. So who we want to know as much as possible about the get refuser. Who are they? Who's their support network? Is this coming from them? Is this coming from a friend or family member or even Rav? Can we go to that person directly? Sometimes it's a lot of community education that if this person is getting support from a community, how can we engage with that community and explain where we're coming from and hear where they're coming from and see if we can then leverage that support network to encourage the get refuser to change their perspective. And I remember one situation actually where a group of friends sat down with another friend in their group who was not giving a get. And this man was really focused on not giving a get. He even brought his legal counsel to his friend meeting. And they basically said, we, you know, care about you and we want to be your friend, but we can't be your friend if you're going to withhold this get. And he gave a get within a few days of that. And that was never public. You don't know this person's name. And that kind of behind the scenes social network pressure can be extremely helpful. We also find that knowing pressure is coming is incredibly impactful. I believe it was maybe mid last year, but we had 6 cases in a row resolve the day before the case was going to go public. So our social media was very quiet because we had all these planned posts that we kept canceling, but for good reason. But in many of these cases, it's kind of the anxiety of knowing that my name's going to be out there that got people to, in anticipation of that, go ahead and give the get and resolve things. And that's a really important thing to know, that for every case you see plastered on social media, there's 10 more people that saw that and were like, man, I'm going to skip out on that experience. And so it can really have a deterrent effect, but you have to create that opportunity for them to know it's coming and then consider whether they want that to happen or not. Because if it just happens and there's no heads up and there's no warning, then you lose a really powerful opportunity to then encourage them to consider, like, do I want to do this? And sometimes it's getting a third party who they trust to talk to them and say, listen, like, I think you're a good person. I don't like the idea of your name going out in the community as this abuser and get withholder. Like, it doesn't have to go there. Like, let's pause and kind of think about the big picture. And I do think that so much of these terrible divorces come down to being so stuck in the conflict of the moment that you can't, like, look up and think, well, what do I want from my life? What do I want my life to look like in 5 years? How can I think big picture and get beyond the moment? So sometimes it's an outside person that can help them get that sort of longer perspective and come out of this anger and frustration and conflict that they're really embroiled in. And then if amicable efforts don't work, we then go ahead to pressure. So if we are out pressuring, it's because we tried other things and those things didn't work. And pressure can include publishing their name in the media, social media campaigns. It can include demonstrations outside their home or place of work. It can be mailings. And the way that we think about pressure is that we want it to be incremental. We don't want to play all of our cards and then all the cards are played and there's nothing else. And we want to create consistency. We want the person to know that we're in it for the long haul and we are not going to go away. And so the ongoing pressure, I think, is more powerful than if it's like a bad week. We've all had a bad week. We can get to the other end of it. And I think there's a real balancing act where you want to pressure the person in a way that's meaningful. You don't want them to be like, you know, oh, this is no big deal. But on the other hand, you also don't want it to get to this place of no return where they feel like they're total pariahs. They'll never reintegrate into the community. They'll never find someone to remarry within the community. So why even bother? You always want them to feel like there's a way back. And so sometimes in a way, when pressure campaigns are too successful, that can also be a challenge because then the person hits that sort of place of no return and they're actually much harder to work with. So we're always trying to find this balance where we are putting that pressure in, but we're not doing it so much that then we totally lose the person. And of course, there's also always a risk that a get refuser will radicalize, that they'll get online, they'll start meeting other get refusers, and then it almost becomes part of their identity. Who am I? I'm a get refuser and I'm proud of it. And that once it really becomes like part of their identity and kind of in their bones like that, it's very, very difficult to convince them to change their path. And so there's a real balance to all of it where you always want to try the amicable first because you can't really go from pressure to let's go out for pizza and you'll tell me, you know, what's on your mind. So you kind of have to do those in order. And having the threat of pressure, because that is really what gets people moving. And finding that balance where the pressure is incremental and it's impactful, but it's also not getting them sort of beyond the pale where you're not going to get them back. And all of this, I should say as well, is only done to the extent the Agunot is comfortable with it. So some Agunot do not want their case public. And some of them have teenagers who are going to read everything online and they're concerned about that. And some of them might have safety concerns about if pressure is almost too impactful on the get refuser. And so you're always balancing all of those pieces with what is this Agu not comfortable with? What does she want or not want? And for us, we really place a huge value on giving Agu note agency over this process, that it's not that we're the experts and we're going to tell you what to do. It's that we trust that you know this guy better than any of us, and we trust your opinion on what's going to be effective and what you're comfortable with, and we work within those parameters.
Are your clients primarily women, or do men come to you also?
So both come to us, and I would say we primarily work with women, certainly. On our helpline, there's a decent mix. Definitely more majority women, but I would say a good core group of men. And when it comes to our full-fledged Agu not cases, we do have several Agu not cases that we've worked on over the years. And so it typically happens in one direction, but it can happen the other way where the wife refuses to receive the get, and we do work on those cases as well.
I can't have an episode now and not ask you about the loud. It's almost like it's awakened this topic up again. And what comes to mind is, where's the leadership? Where are the rabbis? Why have things gone this far? You might not want to answer what your position on what's happening, but do you feel like all the leverage has been lost because it's gone so public and extreme? Or whatever she does may, in fact, you know, raise the bar and make the threat so much stronger for everyone else, so they are helping long term. So I'd like to hear your analysis on, you know, what are the pros and maybe what are the cons of trying something like this out.
And to give context, I'm referring to Flatbush Girl, aka Adina Miles, who's been campaigning publicly on social media and on the streets of Kiryas Jalil and Williamsburg with protests and the mikveh strike.
So again, with anything that's meta successful in a way that's really all over the place, there is always a risk that the person reaches that place of no return. At the same time, I'm often a believer in doing something versus nothing. So, you know, I've taken plenty of advocacy moves that are risky. I will note everything we do is civilly legal and halakhically permissible, so nothing outside those boundaries. But we will make moves that come with risk. And generally, we're choosing them because we've tried the other options and they haven't worked. So I think it is important to put it into context that advocacy comes with risks, and you're always balancing the something versus nothing, because you can also look at 10 ideas, come up with risks for all of them, and chances are there will be risks for all of them, and then go home and do nothing, and that's not necessarily better either. So without commenting on the ins and outs of that case, I think that would be sort of a case-specific decision. And I think that, you know, one of the really hard parts of the Agu not issue is that it's been going on a long time. So sometimes there's this sense of like, oh yeah, that thing, it's really bad. We really should deal with that. But it's hard to feel a sense of urgency around it. That like, no, we have to do something. We have to do something now. And so what the benefit of cases that go viral, that get a ton of attention, is that it creates this urgency that can be really, really hard to find on an issue that's so old and so hard to address. And so the urgency is great. And how you weigh it in a specific case, you really have to know that case. And this isn't a case that I'm involved in or know personally. So I just wouldn't be able to speak to, does this make sense? But I'll say for us, this is a conversation we have with Agu not all the time. I just had a conversation with an Agu not about this last week. You know, we could do X and it would probably come with these risks. But on the other hand, the other option is Y, which might be worse and might leave us with less options. And so a lot of the conversations we have are about being honest about those risks and really working with Agu not to figure out what's the best of bad options. And very, very often, that's the choice you're making. There's no golden ticket here. It's, you know, we have five options. They might all stink, but let's pick one and let's do it wholeheartedly and see where that goes. And I think part of the goal of prevention is that once you're in these really bad cases, you often don't have amazing options. So the goal is to change that dynamic from the beginning, because once you're in it, it's often the best of the bad options. And that's a conversation that I have really openly with a Ugnote that we work with.
Are there any other risks in terms of this kind of public social extreme movement, especially something like the mikveh strike, where you're getting civilian Jews participating using Jewish law and ritual? Is it effective?
Listen, there are always risks to everything. So the question is, are those risks worth it? The way I think about it is that I really think about advocacy and change as something that happens in an ecosystem. One thing, even a really successful movement, rarely kind of moves the needle on its own. I think you need this larger system of different people doing things in different ways that all comes together to create change. So something that's more out there, that's more extreme, certain people and certain communities are going to be really excited about that and really connected to that. And other people are going to be turned off by it and like, oh, no, that's, I feel like that's distasteful, or that's not halachic, or that's not for me. And I think that's why it's so important there are different people doing the work in different ways. So what I would say is that if you're watching this and thinking, ugh, bless, not for me, okay, that's totally fine. We all should make these decisions for ourselves. Find someone who's doing this in a way that you can connect with, because there really are a range of people who are working on this issue, and we're all bringing different styles, different perspectives, different priorities. And not everyone is, so I have a certain way of doing this work that is going to be perfect and right on the spot for some people, and it's going to be too conservative or too liberal or too this or too that for other people. That's fine. Find the person who you connect with. Find the organization that I think you feel like there's a kinship there between how you approach these issues, and find a way to do something. And that's, I would say, I think is the biggest message and takeaway. Not every style is going to be for everyone. And I would hope that people who are watching this and thinking, oh, that's not my style, instead of just being turned off to the issue at large, which of course is a risk that they might just say, Aguna advocacy, not my thing. My hope would be that they can find a pathway towards Aguna advocacy that they can really feel comfortable and excited about and do something. Because there is a real need for change, and there are many, many ways to go about this kind of change. So if one way is not for you, find another way.
So what are some ways anyone listening to this podcast can participate? Let's say they don't want to participate in a mikveh strike. Let's say they don't want to go to a demonstration. What are things that they can do?
So certainly social media.
And they don't know any Agunas.
Right.
No one came out to them. They probably know Agunas, but they don't know that they're Agunas.
So one preventative tool that we are very passionate about is the halachic prenup, which is a document you can sign before you get married, and you can also sign it as a postnup after you're married. And it basically creates an incentive structure where we're a lot less likely to see the get used in an abusive way later on.
Has anyone who signed the prenup or postnup still, have there been issues? Has it always proven to be successful? That's my question.
So here's what I would say. I have worked on many, many prenup enforcement cases. There are a handful that have been challenging. I would say that even in that handful, they got their get much faster and in a much smoother way than they would have without having a prenup. So if you compare their situation to someone who didn't have a prenup, they did much better. But again, it's not a perfect tool, and I'm a lawyer, so nothing can be perfect, you know? But the goal is to do a few things. The goal is that certainly in the vast, vast majority of cases, it's working exactly like it should. It's working quickly. It's working smoothly. Even in the minority of cases where it's a challenge, it's still better to have it than not to have it. And the most important part of the prenup is really the culture change element. That if you live in a community where everyone signs a prenup, where the rabbi won't marry you without a prenup, where it's built into the fabric and the culture around you, that's a community where you don't want to be a get refuser. And numbers are going down. These are communities where most people don't necessarily have prenups. The prenup is still new enough that unless you've been to a postnup party, you don't necessarily have one, even if, you know, if you've been married past that 5 to 10 year mark. However, these are communities where we're seeing very few people choose get refusal because the social cost is higher. And for every person that's willing to be a pariah, again, 10 other people are not. And so it really has a very, very significant culture change. And that's why it's so important. And I'm mentioning postnup specifically because we've actually had couples host postnup parties and invite friends and family. And it can be a very light, fun, you know, we're not talking like super intense and sad and, you know, scary content, but it's a way to show that I'm doing something active because I want to be part of creating change. And every couple, especially who signs a postnup, it really sends the message that this isn't something that you do because you're afraid about, you're insecure about your relationship, or you're afraid you're going to need it. But this is something that you do because you want to help clients grow and you want to be part of creating change. And that's it. And so postnup parties are a great way to be involved. I'll also mention volunteering. If you have a professional skill, you're a lawyer, you're a therapist, you're, you know, an artist, there could be ways that you can use that to help Agunot and to help the cause. And so, and I really feel like any gift that God's given us, we can use that gift to help our communities. And so volunteering expertise can be a really gratifying way to be involved. And especially for attorneys, we have a pro bono network of attorneys that will take on cases for free when needed, that really provide incredibly impactful support to Agunot. And we would love to grow that. We also have volunteers that will accompany women to Basin, not as advocates. So this isn't about sort of training as an attorney, but just really as a form of support. Not everyone has someone to go with them. And as an advocacy organization, we're not always the right person to show up in a uncontested get situation. That might sort of set things off in a way that isn't helpful. But there are community members who volunteer their time. And again, you don't have to commit to everything in advance, but if an opportunity arises and you're available, they'll go. We had students this year who built Sukkot for Agunot. We have a program for college students. And so some of our college student fellows and alumni went and again, built sukkahs to help take that off the list for Agunot that we work with. There are really so many ways to be involved, so many ways to contribute, and they don't all have to be these big dramatic things. They could be sort of small things that you can fit into the rest of your life. But I think the biggest piece is that it's so easy to feel like unless this issue impacts me or someone I know, I don't have to touch it. And we get that it's an awkward and uncomfortable issue at times, but we really believe that it's when every one of us sees this as something on our, you know, job description, something on our to-do list, that we're really going to see collective change. So to just encourage you to find some way to engage, some way to be involved, some way to use your talents and your resources to help. And I'll share as well, monetary support is not nothing either. Many of the agencies doing this work, including Aura, offer our services for free. And that's really important to us. And that's literally only possible because of support that we get from our communities. So that is also, we have, you know, monthly donors that give $5 a month that don't necessarily have a lot to give, but that adds up and it makes a difference. And so there are many ways to be involved, all with different resources. And I think it's figuring out what works for you, what's meaningful to you, and what little piece of this you can take on so that you're part of creating a community that is healthier and safer for everyone.
So it's probably tricky for you to answer this question because you need to be in the good graces of rabbis and rabbinic figures in leadership position. But when the question comes up, where is rabbinic leadership? And what about all the Beis Din that are corrupt? And we have the Rate My Beis Din website that Chochmat Nashim put up. And I think, I don't know because I'm not following up, but that seems to have brought a little bit more accountability to Beis Din. But what do you think in terms of leadership in general? Do you feel like there is a leadership and is the leadership reliable? Is everything done independently and you sort of have a bad apple and a good apple? And yeah.
I think there's a few layers to this. One thing that's really challenging, and especially when we talk about rabbinic leadership or rabbinic activism, is that we don't have centralized rabbinic leadership in the Jewish world today. So there's no Sanhedrin. There's no intergalactic Beit Din that's in charge of everybody. There's no one that really has the authority to change halakha for everyone. And so you're working in a system that is much more piecemeal and that does lack that centralized authority that could in some ways just come in and make a ruling that everyone would listen. So a lot of things are rabbi by rabbi, community by community. Do I think that there are places where we don't have enough moral courage? Yes. And I think moral courage is a real challenge here. This is not an issue that makes you popular. Chances are, whatever you do, half the people are like, bravo. And half the people are like, you're a terrible person. And, you know, I can't wait for God to punish you in the afterlife. And so you're going to get all of that. And sometimes we all as humans have a tendency to want to please everyone as opposed to, I feel that this is right. And so I'm going to do it. That being said, I think from a practical perspective, I don't like lumping people into sort of lumpy groups. I don't think it helps so much. So I feel like when I work with rabbis, I try very hard to just deal with them as people instead of coming to them with, oh, the rabbis, you guys don't do anything. I don't know that that is all that effective in sort of a one-on-one conversation. And believe me, there are rabbis I work with that have taken enormous steps to help women and done so at tremendous cost to themselves. So there are rabbis that are doing amazing work in this area. There are rabbis that it would be great if they would do more. There's everything because they're people. They're not this sort of monolith or this 10-headed monster. They're a group of individuals, and some of them are incredible, and some of them are challenging, and there's a lot of people in between. And so I think instead of approaching rabbis as, well, you all stink, and so do better, I try to approach it more as, in this conversation, what resources can I give you to encourage you to do what I think would be really helpful and impactful here? Or when we're doing training for rabbis, it's also recognizing that these situations are hard for them. No rabbi is just like waiting for a really terrible divorce case to come to their community so they can be right in the middle of it, right? It's a hard spot to be in. And I try to frame our work as much as possible as, I think that you're capable of really doing good work here and really doing the right thing. And I recognize where it's really hard and risky for you. And so what resources can I give you to make that more doable and to make you feel like you're not alone in this? Because it's, leadership is always a lonely place to be. And so thinking about how can we help support and encourage rabbis to do what we hope they will do while understanding the challenges versus and treating them as individuals versus thinking of it as this like big conglomeration of bad people who don't care, where I just don't think that's reflective of the real people. And I don't think it's effective in terms of, if you want them to do differently, to do something differently, treating them like this evil 10-headed monster is not going to make you, is not going to make them do anything different from my perspective.
So I'm so grateful we did this conversation that you agreed to come on and talk to us once again, because the point of this conversation is that there's a lot to be done. There's a lot that is being done, and most of it is behind the scenes because that is has been the most effective for the majority of people to get this done before it becomes public or to find their humanity, find the humanity of the rabbis, whatever it is. Pre-publicity, which is why most people don't either hear about the cases or don't know about the work that you do, which is why I think it's so important that we talk about it, because at least my chat explodes when these things come up on social media or in media in general. So it's a hot topic, and it's important to hear that there are effective methods that are out there and you can get access to them and they can be effective for you or for someone you know. And sometimes keeping quiet for as long as possible is your best hand. And not calling somebody a get refuser. I'm assuming that's one of the steps you want to avoid for as long as possible, right?
Definitely. And I think our goal is to be strategic about it, to do what we think is going to be effective versus what is going to feel satisfying, and to really, really pay attention to what the agunel wants and where she's at and what she's comfortable with, and to really have that be a guiding force, because it is limiting. And I do want to be clear about that. There is a tension sometimes between prioritizing the agunel's needs and comfort and resolving a case quickly. Those don't always go together. And we've chosen to really prioritize that comfort and decision-making and empowering of the agunel. And that can sometimes be at the cost of resolving a case. But we also want to think about our cases in terms of, again, what is going to strategically get this person what they want most as soon as we possibly can. And how do we weigh that with all of the different competing factors involved, keeping in mind that there's no easy answer?
There are women who say, you know, for my mental health, we can't keep pushing or do something more drastic. I'd rather not have a get.
Absolutely. And we'll respect that.
Do you have numbers you can share with us?
So we work with about 75 people in our, again, primarily women, but in our sort of full-fledged agunel department. And we work with another approximately 400 people who are earlier in the process. And that's where, again, we're doing a lot of guidance and strategy and how do we help you get through this process in the strongest and healthiest way possible. And we also do a lot of connecting people with other resources they might not know about. You know, there are so many financial challenges that come with divorce or, you know, parenting challenges. And so sometimes it's also looping them in addition to the advice and support we're giving them, looping them into other resources. We also run support groups and we do art therapy and financial literacy trainings and a lot of programs to kind of just help people through the trauma of this experience as well. So there's a whole range of resources. And then we do a lot of educational work as well. So educating thousands of students and adults every year on what get refusal is, the connection between get refusal and abuse, on signing halachic prenups. And the goal in doing that is to normalize it. We want to get to students starting at the high school age so that by the time they're engaged, it's not weird because they already know about it. And so the goal is to really do this in a systemic way so that we change how people think and feel about this issue and about the available solutions, and we overcome some of the barriers to making those solutions possible.
So last question, I know I'm jumping earlier, but you said some of the women come to you before they even announced or presented the idea of divorce to their partners, to their spouses. What would you say, what are the strategies? And isn't that blindsiding to the point where it might backfire? So What does that look like?
So that can look like a few different things. If someone's in an abusive situation, it might be a referral for safety planning. So safety planning is a way to think about how do you keep yourself safe when you're living in a really dangerous relationship and how do you plan to get out safely, because that moment where you leave can be very volatile and very dangerous. So the risk of blindsiding them is significant. Often there is a runway for divorce. So people are thinking about it. They're saving money. They're, you know, getting a degree so that they can go and earn more money when they leave. It can be a process sometimes of several years. And it can be a long process where people might be thinking about it and not sure if they want to pursue it. And for us, again, we're not directing people. You have to stay together. You have to get divorced. If they want support in figuring that out, we'll give them referrals to mental health support. And if they can't afford mental health support, we will do our best to give them referrals to free services so that they can have a trained professional who can just guide them through what's right for them and whether couples therapy makes sense or not. Couples therapy and abuse can be a bad shit up. And so it depends on the situation and what's appropriate. But it's really about giving people a safe space to talk about things that they might not have anyone else in their lives that they can talk about, because, you know, it's too personal or it's too much of a bombshell. And so it's being a safe space for people that are in difficult situations that are trying to figure out what's right for them, with the reality that we can't tell them do X, Y, Z, and that's going to be the right answer, but that we want to be a safe place to help them move forward on their path, whatever their path is going to be, with the resources that they really need. And it could be connecting them with Ravanim if that's important to them, so they feel like they have someone they can speak to about the halachot or about the ideas of shalom bayis, that maybe they're not comfortable going to their husband's rabbi for that, and they want someone to talk through those Jewish concepts with. And so it could be any number of things, but it's really being there for people and meeting them where they are and giving them the support they need to turn this really terrifying process into a pathway with clear steps.
Yeah. And I'd love to post the information for the hotline, the helpline. And is there anything else you'd like to say? I think we covered what we wanted to cover, right?
Absolutely. I think the biggest closing message I would offer is that there is a way to get involved for everyone, and it might be different, and that's okay. But to encourage people to feel like this is something that matters to me, that I want to be involved in some way, because this happens more than you think to people that are closer than you think. And it should never be that we wait until it happens to us to care. And so these moments, whether we agree with them or disagree with them, can be a really important catalyst to say, well, I care about this, so what can I do?
Okay. Thank you so much, Keshet Star. It was great having you. As always, love talking to you.
Same here. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening until the end. If you enjoyed this episode, please let me know. Please give us a 5-star rating and review on your podcast listening app. Also, please share this podcast with a friend or family member. I always love hearing from you, and I hope you have a great rest of your week. Stay safe, be kind. Speak to you next time.